Iowa's Safe Haven Act is all about saving the lives of babies unwanted by their mothers. This week in the news, a reminder of how important that law is. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also in this hour of Quick Conversations, how much oversight should faith-based drug treatment programs have? This Is My Brave destigmatizes mental illness. NASA's Kepler mission announces the discovery of nearly 1,300 more planets. We check in with Newsweek's featured Iowa teenager 50 years later. And a crop and weather update with Elwyn Taylor. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations on our Fridays. We call it News Buzz. Quick conversations to round off the week in news. This week, according to a University of Iowa police report, a 22-year-old gave birth in a bathroom at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics. Then, thinking the baby was dead, tried to flush it down a toilet. Then left the baby in a trash can where it was found. Alive. The Davenport woman is now facing a child endangerment charge, an aggravated misdemeanor with a penalty of up to 2 years in prison. Police said the mother told them she didn't realize she was pregnant. The father of the child is not known, and citing federal privacy laws, the hospital officials would not release information about the baby's condition. But what is clear is this young woman possibly could have avoided charges under Iowa's Safe Haven Act, which was enacted in 2002. Joining us to talk about this law, Amy McCoy, Public Information Officer at the Iowa Department of Human Services. Also, Tracy Parker, Adoption Program Manager at the Iowa DHS. Tracy and Amy, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Amy, start us off by telling us about the Safe Haven Act. What circumstances is it meant to cover?
Right. Safe haven is there for a mother or a family that's in crisis to be able to safely hand over care and custody of a newborn infant at a hospital or another healthcare facility. And this law applies to infants up to 14 days old. Parents or their representative can take the infant to a hospital or healthcare facility, and they can do that with no questions asked. So they can remain anonymous. And what this does is it helps protect newborn infants whose families feel like they're in crisis and can't care for them.
Mm-hmm. So how does that work in practice? You can walk up to any hospital, certain hospitals, a certain place in the hospital?
It's any hospital, any place in the hospital, and any healthcare facility. So you can look at any residential care facility or nursing facility, facilities for people with mental illness. So really facilities that are open on a 24/7 basis. And they can speak with staff. They could also leave the child and then call. They just need to make sure that someone is alerted that the child is there.
Mm-hmm. And then, Tracy, the baby finds its way into the adoption program?
Yes. Once a child is taken to a safe haven facility, staff call the Department of Human Services, and we obtain a court order to have custody of the child. Within 30 days, the juvenile court will file a petition to terminate parental rights. And then once parental rights are terminated, the child is available for adoption. Typically, when children come in through a safe haven situation, they're placed in a home that is a strong possibility of being an adoptive home. And so we go through the adoption process, and then it is finalized.
Mm-hmm. Amy, how many babies have been given up under this act since 2002?
Yeah, the department has used the safe haven procedures 25 times since 2002. So it shows that people are really knowing about the law, using this provision to help keep infants safe.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit, I don't know which of you know more of the background, of what prompted this law? Because most states, if not all states, do have such a law. What were the circumstances that led to it?
Yeah, and I'll start off. There was a high-profile case in 2001 of someone who gave birth to a child, and the infant died. And so legislators looked at that situation and thought there has to be a way for people who are in crisis to be able to hand over care and custody safely. And so they did develop the Safe Haven Law, and it makes it very simple for someone to go to that hospital or healthcare facility or their representative. If, you know, if the mother's just given birth, she's not able to do it, she can find a representative to do that as well. But there's laws like this across the country in all of the states. There's some differences between each of them in, you know, the age of the infant or the type of facility. But really, it's been recognized widely that being able to do this can save infants' lives.
Mm-hmm. We don't know whether this particular woman knew about the Safe Haven law. I wonder, Amy, is one of the biggest challenges here making people aware so that in a time of crisis, they know they can give up a baby, that the baby's life and well-being is first and foremost, no questions asked, without fear of being prosecuted for abandonment?
Yes, it's important for people to understand that there is no prosecution for abandonment when it comes to the Safe Haven, and that they really can go and have a no questions asked kind of scenario to be able to do this. So when we do have Safe Haven babies, we release that information to the press. While we can't release the details about it, we do let people know we've used those Safe Haven procedures again. And then we do get a lot of inquiries about our foster care and adoption system at those times too. And, of course, we're welcoming people to give us a call if they're interested in fostering or adopting a child with special needs. We don't have as many infants coming into our system because a lot of people arrange private adoptions mm-hmm. for infants if they feel like they're not going to be able to care for them.
Right. That leads me to just to give us in the minute or two that we have remaining a profile of adoption in the state. There are many more who would like to adopt, especially infants, than there are infants available. Is that right?
Right. And many of those infants do go through the private adoption system. And that's because a lot of parents who are giving up custody of their child, they still would like some information about them. And they're able to arrange for an open adoption through that. And then with our system, we're generally helping children who have had trauma or abuse as part of their past find a home.
Mm-hmm. So there are babies and certainly kids waiting for adoption.
Absolutely. And if people are interested in learning more about adopting through the state, they can go to iowakidsnet.com and they're going to find more information there. Iowa KidsNet helps us train families and get them ready to be foster and adoptive families.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tracy Parker, Adoption Program Manager at the Iowa Department of Human Services. Amy McCoy with us as well, Public Information Officer at the Iowa DHS. Tracy, Amy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now, Iowa law states that people in the state with a drug or alcohol problem are required to have access to sound medical treatment. That means evaluations by trained clinicians, individualized treatment plans, emergency services, and treatment programs overseen by state regulators. However, for more than 40 years, faith-based organizations have been given an exemption by the Iowa legislature from such standards. Lee Rood joins me now, Des Moines Register reporter and editor, and she's been looking into the question of how much oversight should faith-based treatment programs have. Lee Rood, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Ben.
In your article, you focus, as an example, on the story of one Alex Jacobson who lives in the Spencer, Iowa area. Can you tell us what happened with him?
Yeah, so Alex is a 26-year-old graduate of the University of Iowa who had really been struggling since high school with major depression and anxiety. He had tried a number of prescription drugs and dabbled with marijuana and drinking, et cetera. He just always said that he felt ill at ease in crowds and had a lot of anxiety in general. He had talked to his pastor at an Assemblies of God church in Spencer, who had just started a new residential treatment program at the Spencer Dream Center, a nonprofit there, and it was unlicensed. And part of the rules of that program were for him to stop taking any mood-altering drugs. Right away, Alex expressed concerns, and he expressed that he wasn't feeling well in the program. And 10 days after joining the program, he attempted suicide by cutting his own throat with a box cutter he found lying around.
Mm-hmm. So what is his condition now?
So that was in January, and he underwent some pretty extensive counseling. He's had struggles since then with suicidal thoughts. He's been readmitted a couple times to different programs. He's been in the Spencer Hospital, but right now he's in a hospital in Sioux City where he's undergoing some special treatment still with his disorder.
Mm-hmm. So you've been in contact with Alex's family. So what are they asking for here?
So they wanted me to look into this because I don't think what many people realize is that a faith-based program like this is exempt from any sort of standards that apply to licensed programs. And part of that has to do with the dispersing of drugs and medical oversight and training. So I looked into it, and it is different than licensed facilities.
Mm-hmm. So you can have faith, I mean, in anything? Is there any standard here, or can you have faith in, I don't know, breakfast cereal or something to cure your ails?
Well, this is this exemption is specifically having to do with sort of drug treatment. By the way, Alcoholics Anonymous also has an exemption, but it doesn't have residential programs in Iowa. So I think the concern was not at all so much having to do with the faith-based curriculum, although experts, you know, have expressed doubts about how well that works. It had to do with the lack of oversight. You know, experts told me that requiring somebody to go off a prescription drug can be, while somebody's going through withdrawal, can be really dangerous. You can have suicidal thoughts. It can be deadly in cases. Alex was on some pretty serious antidepressants and antipsychotics. And the feelings he expressed of having insomnia, he was visibly sweating, all these things kind of fit in with withdrawal symptoms. So,
mm-hmm. How has the community of Spencer, the surrounding area, reacted to this one case?
I think that they're still processing. I've talked to the family. I've talked to one of the pastors. A lot of people in Spencer are very fond of this Dream Center, which does a lot to help people who are down and out. But I think people really do have concerns about this kind of treatment without oversight for all the reasons I've just sort of said.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what would be the path forward to get some oversight here, to measure the effectiveness of these faith-based organizations. Is there evidence there to measure?
Well, you know, what's interesting is I just got off the phone earlier today with, I'm writing a story today about new rules that would affect any sort of unlicensed program for youth that were drafted in the aftermath of what happened at Midwest Academy in Keokuk, would also apply to youth programs, at least in Iowa, that do drug treatment. So that's something new that's happening right now. The governor has yet to sign the legislation, but we're anticipating that he would, since he called for this legislation after Midwest Academy in Keokuk was raided by federal authorities. It too was unlicensed. And in that case, there were, you know, concerns about child abuse and overuse of restraint on children.
Mm-hmm. Do you sense that this will be an issue in the upcoming legislative session? Doesn't start till January, but will cases like this fuel some rethinking here, possibly by the legislature?
I think a lot of people are talking about it. You know, nobody I've talked to is expressing concern so much about the faith-based approach. As much as I think people within DHS and public health are concerned about the proper disbursement and regulation of medicines that they may need for mental illness.
Okay. Thank you very much. Lee Rood, Des Moines Register reporter and editor. Quickly, are you going to follow up this with other articles?
Oh, yeah. There will be more articles coming for sure over the next couple weeks.
Okay. Thank you, Lee Rood of the Des Moines Register. Incidentally, in Iowa, free help for drug treatment can be found by calling Your Life Iowa at 1-855-581-8111. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Reporting on scientific advances in understanding mental illness and discussing those advances, as we often do on this program, is one way to help end the stigma surrounding mental illness. Now, the production This Is My Brave also aims to end that stigma, but in a different way, by letting individuals living with or loving someone with mental illness present their own stories via essay, original music, and poetry on stage. A production of This Is My Brave comes to Iowa City with a performance tonight at 7 p.m. at the Coralville Performing Arts Center. Here's a sample of the type of personal story you might hear. This one taken from my interview last year before the performance then.
I was first hospitalized in January of 2013 for suicidal thinking. And there was a guy who, the short version of the story, he slipped me a piece of paper that said, if you could be king for a day, what would you do? All power and control would be up to you. And I wrote on it, I would make sure that everyone knew that they were loved. And I gave it back to him. And then later he found me and he gave it to me. And I said, no, I want you to keep it. And he said, no, I want you to keep it.
Joining me now, Brooke Easton, local producer for This Is My Brave, and Katie Roche, a band member of the Iowa City-based group. You've all heard of them, the Awful Purdies. Brooke and Katie, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Brooke, remind us a little more detail for those who haven't heard as well. What is This Is My Brave all about, and what's the idea behind it?
The biggest idea is that we all have a story to tell. And the thing is that sometimes we're really scared to tell those stories, and especially when they revolve around mental illness. But I've learned over the years as I've shared my story that it really can change the perception of mental illness. It can change the perception of people who are suffering, and it can offer comfort. And there's a compassion there that is lost until those stories are shared.
Right. And while there are many different types of mental illnesses and different degrees of that people suffer through and cope with, the message here seems to be you are not alone.
That's exactly right. Yeah. You are not alone. One of the biggest things that we did at last year's show was we had everyone at the end of the show stand up. And I asked them, I said, if you've ever been touched or influenced by mental illness or loved somebody, please stand up. And the entire audience stood up. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks volumes for when we're talking about a disease that affects one in four people.
Mm-hmm. Would you mind sharing a little bit of your story?
Oh, sure. Definitely. So a little bit of my story. I have a very long family history of mental health issues. I have a grandparent who had depression. My dad was manic depressive. I have what they call borderline personality disorder, which is kind of like a catch-all for anxiety and all the things. My two sons suffer from anxiety. And so it's just been a really big family thing. But, you know, I think people would think that that's really sad, you know, but it's actually so hopeful. I always tell my son, I say, the reason that your little baby soul picked me is because he knew that I've been through this and that I can help you.
Mm.
And so through my experiences with anxiety and mental health issues, I can be, you know, pave that a better road for my son. Mm-hmm. In so many ways.
There wasn't always this time when you were able to share this so freely. What was that like to cross over from keeping it in the shadows to making it public? What difference did that make? Was there a moment that you did that?
You know, the ironic part is when you try and keep it a secret, it makes the anxiety grow exponentially.
Mm.
So keeping the secret itself perpetuates the mental illness that you have. So the more that you can be open about it, the more that you can be honest about it, that right there was a huge weight lifted off my shoulders. And once I was able to open up about it and tell everybody, and, you know, no one threw stones at me, no one threw rocks at me, everyone was very supportive. And I heard so many me toos, me too, I also have this, you know, would you like to get together for coffee? Do you want to talk about it? And I'm like, always, always. I will always be there to talk to you about it.
Tell us a little bit. I know Katie's going to be part of this year's performance. We'll hear from her in just a moment. But give us an overview of what's going to be happening tonight at the Coralville Performing Arts Center.
So we have a really interesting, there's a returning person who's going to be singing. Joe Sorensen is coming back for a second year, which is amazing. His music is phenomenal. And as we all like to say, we're going to know him when. And then also we have a couple who their title of their piece is crazymatch.com. So I'll just let you run with that a little bit.
All right.
And then just a lot of stories of people who have struggled against the odds and they've come out on the other side. Mm-hmm. They've really come out and they are successful and they are healing. And it's just an amazing story.
Mm-hmm. Katie Roche, you'll be performing. Tell us about the performance tonight and how it ties into this theme.
So we're going to be performing a song that I wrote for my band Awful Parties called Homesick Birds. And I wrote Homesick Birds because I was thinking about kind of all the multitudes that people contain and how it's really easy to feel incredibly fragmented and sometimes feel like an imposter in our own lives because of all that fragmentation. And I think it's really strange to kind of land in your own body and be expected to be a whole person. And having had friends and family members throughout my life who've struggled with mental illness, I know that it's incredibly hard to navigate the complexity of both your inner life and then your day in and your day out. So I wrote this song as in love and empathy for all the people that struggle.
Okay, let's listen to this original music written by Katie Roche and performed by the Awful Purdies. You can see a live performance of it tonight. Let's hear a little bit of Katie Roche's original work, Homesick Birds, performed by Katie and the rest of the Awful Purdies.
That you had to keep sweat. Just a dirty one. Careful one, I'm all the dogs who drink water all night but can't get to the door. I'm all the couples who sleep one on the bed.
Okay, a little taste of what you'll hear tonight if you attend the Coralville Performing Arts Center's performance, the production of This Is My Brave. I do love that voice and all the expression behind it. Katie Roche, beautiful song there. Homesick Birds, Brooke Easton, thank you for joining us. How do people find out more about this production?
Yes. So you can hop online to thisismybrave.org, or you can actually visit the Coralville Center for Performing Arts webpage, and they also have all the information that you need. Doors open tonight at 6 p.m. and you can get tickets at the door.
Okay. Brooke Easton and Katie Roche, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
I'm all the landlords, old ladies, and lawyers who never get a rest. I was never a closed book. My mystery's written by aeroplanes.
I'm going to take a short break and back with more News Buzz on this edition of River to River. NASA's Kepler mission announces the discovery of nearly 1,300 more planets. We'll talk with our favorite astronomer, Steve Kowaler of Iowa State University, about that. Also, Elwin Taylor with a crop and weather update when we come back. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, NASA announced this week the Kepler spacecraft mission has discovered nearly 1,300 more planets. Yes, nearly 1,300 more in addition to what it's already discovered. This brings Kepler's total to more than 2,000 planets discovered. Joining me now, as he has in the past with other major Kepler announcements, someone who has long been associated with the Kepler mission, Steve Kowaler is an astronomy professor at Iowa State University. Hello again, Steve.
Hi, Ben.
Remind us quickly, what is Kepler all about? What does it set out to do?
Kepler's role is to find planets around other stars, as many as possible in a finite volume of space so that we can figure out how many planets there are all over.
Okay, so tell us about these newly discovered planets to 1,284, according to my notes.
That sounds almost right. the Kepler mission had already found over 1,000 planets, and as we find more and more planets, or more and more candidates, planets in the Kepler data, it gets harder and harder to confirm that they are planets and not some sort of background astrophysical process. So we want to be sure that the signal that we're seeing, this little tiny drop in the light from a star, is caused indeed by a planet crossing in front of it. What makes this recent slew of detections or confirmations so special is that it was done with a new technique. The technique involves using what we've already learned from the previous Kepler discoveries to reduce the chance that what we're seeing is misidentified as a planet. So it's a new statistical technique based on what we've learned about what planets actually do look like around other stars that has given us the confidence to call these new 1,280 or so detections actual planets.
Okay, so these 1,280 and these other 1,000 or so that Kepler has discovered, are they spread out across the sky, or are they in one narrow band or patch in the sky?
They're confined to a fairly narrow patch, about the size of your fist, if you hold your fist up to the sky, make sure no one else is looking. That's about the size of the sky that Kepler looked at for a little over 4 years. And all of the Kepler discoveries have been in that one small patch of the sky.
So in that small patch, there are thousands of planets there. So that has significance when we talk about the entire sky, where we are in this universe.
Absolutely. Kepler is only looking at a tiny fraction of the number of stars in the whole Milky Way galaxy. In fact, it carefully monitored only 150,000 stars. And amongst those 150,000 stars, it's found well over 2,000 planets now.
Mm-hmm. So the first indication that there may be a planet there, what you said is a planet candidate, is when there's a tiny, tiny dimming of light in front of a star that is very far away from us, detected by Kepler.
Right, right. The dip is a few parts per million in the light coming from the star.
Okay, so we have that as the first indication, and then that makes it a candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And then what turns it from a candidate into an actual planet?
Well, first you want to see the dip again. A single dip is rarely conclusive, but if you see two or three dips and they're equally spaced in time, then the chances are good that the dips are caused by something going around that star periodically, like the Earth goes around the Sun. The next step is, if you've got that candidate, you have to make sure it's not something else that Kepler is looking at very close to the star that you think you're looking at. So you want to make sure that the signal's coming from the star that you're targeting and not a background star that could be doing something that stars often do, which is change their brightness periodically.
Mm-hmm. So tell me then, based on that little dip and then reconfirming it, what can you tell about the actual planet from that dip in light?
It's really remarkable how much you can tell from a simple transit, from a simple drop in the light and then a bounce back up. You can determine the size of the planet, the radius of the planet. You can determine the time that it takes to orbit the star, the speed in its orbit around the star. Things you can tell that you would like to know is the mass of the planet and the composition. But just simply from watching those dips, you can get almost everything you need to know about the orbit and the size.
Mm-hmm. So with these thousands of planets discovered, over 2,000. How many of them are possibly Earth-like in the Goldilocks zone, which we've talked about earlier?
Well, that's still somewhat of an open question, a small fraction of the ones that we've seen. The numbers range from 20 to 50 in terms of planets that are at just the right distance from their star, that they're not baked completely by the heat from the star, and they're not frozen by being too far away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, within that subset, if you want a planet like the Earth on which life could develop, you don't want the planet to be too massive, like Jupiter, or too tiny like the Moon. And so the number of planets of the right size in the right place is of order 20.
Mm-hmm. So you've said before, as we've talked about Kepler, that you believe, based on what Kepler has found, that there's life out there somewhere in our galaxy. Does this new set of data change anything for you?
It just makes me feel more confident in that feeling. The more planets we find, the more Earth-like planets we find in this one sample of 150,000, the greater the chances of finding a nice, comfortable Earth-like planet, not necessarily in the Kepler part of the sky, but somewhere in our galaxy.
Mm-hmm. So there's something called the TESS mission that NASA has meant to search for planets around nearby bright stars. Tell us about that.
Well, the TESS mission is in some sense a follow-on to Kepler. Kepler looked at this one tiny patch of sky, well, not so tiny patch of sky, but it looked at very, very faint stars. The planets that we found around those stars, we can't really characterize very well because you need an enormous telescope to do that. TESS is going to look all over the sky, everywhere that you can imagine except where Kepler looked, to try and find planets around much brighter stars. If we're successful in doing that, and we should be, there's about 500,000 stars in the catalog that we're going to be looking at, then we'll be able to use ground-based telescopes and the next generation of space-based telescopes to look at the atmospheres of those newly discovered planets and look for signs of life in the atmospheres. So TESS is sort of the next logical step, not just find ET's home, but find ET's home in places that we can actually study.
So end of the semester at Iowa State University, heading off into the summer. What does the research mean for you in the summertime?
Well, in the summer, I get to actually dig into Kepler data and data from the K2 mission, which was the follow-on to this initial planet search. So I've got a ton of data that's been stacking up on my computer that I'll be able to look through this summer and try and learn a little bit about the stars, not necessarily planet host stars, but other stars.
Okay, so I'm trying to picture what that looks like, data stacking up on your computer. So you've got this data. Now, what are you looking for? What are you looking at? What process do you use?
Well, I'm looking at the measurements of the stars that Kepler and K2 have made, the brightness as a function of time, not looking for these tiny dips so much, but by looking for periodic variations, the things that we might mistake for planets. That tells us a lot about what the structure of the stars are. We're doing basically looking for star quakes to see if we can probe the insides of the stars by how they oscillate.
Uh-huh. Okay. So your mind's way out there in the universe trying to describe it in a better way than we have so far in human history. Does that change your enjoyment of the summer? Do you, you like the same things we do?
Well, it's just another day at work, right? No, there are other things I like to do during the summer as well. We were chatting off air about bicycling, and that's something I really do enjoy.
Mm-hmm. But I guess I mean being aware of how vast, having a better comprehension of most of us of what our universe may contain. Does that change anything about the way you go about your life?
Ever since I was a kid, I knew that the universe was inscrutable, that there were things out there that we really couldn't imagine. And so exploring it and finding new and exciting things, that's kind of what you expect in this field. That said, there are still discoveries that just knock your socks off. And having a little bit of an insight into the details about how this work does gives you even a better appreciation, I think, for how amazing our universe is and really how good a job we're doing as a species in exploring it.
Okay. Steve Kowaler, astronomy professor at Iowa State University. We'll look forward to the next installment of what's out there in our universe.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end our week on this Friday. Here's something very interesting. Newsweek magazine profiled Iowa native Bruce Curtis way back in 1966. It was part of a larger feature 50 years ago that Newsweek produced, focusing on what it meant to be a teenager in America in the 1960s. Now, a half century later, Newsweek has checked back in with these former teenagers in that article, including Bruce Curtis, a resident of Newton. He joins me now. Hello, Bruce. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Ben. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Newsweek described you then as a symbol of America's vanishing rustic life. How did they come to pick you?
You know, Ben, I'm really not too sure. I think part of it probably had an association with maybe a few things in the community and the fact that my father worked for Maytag. I was actively involved in 4-H, Boy Scouts, and a few things here in the community. So I'm assuming it was a search that found me through those means, but I really don't know exactly.
Mm-hmm. What was that experience like of being profiled as a young kid in a small town by this big magazine out of New York?
Ben, it was very interesting to have Newsweek come to Newton, Iowa, kind of small town USA. I had a reporter that interviewed me in this small farmhouse that I grew up in. I had a photographer from New York that followed me around in the early hours of the morning, 5:30, 6 o'clock, when you're sending hay out for the cattle and you're feeding lambs in the barn. And probably a little amusing in the fact that I'm not sure that he was excited about the farm life that we associate back here in Iowa, but he was a trooper, stayed with me on that, and followed me through Central Junior High School, and of course, there was a little bit of a buzz on the school around about Newsweek and a photographer, and why is he following Bruce? And it was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. When it finally came out, did you get some fame there in the area that you lived?
A little bit. It was interesting because there was, you know, being a small community, everybody kind of knows most everybody here, and so it was interesting because there was a lot of people that wanted to get a copy of the magazine. There was a lot of people that brought it up in church and school and a few things like that. So yes, you know, whether it's fame, I'm not sure, but it was fun exposure. Yes. Mm-hmm.
When that feature finally came out after that visit in 1966, looking at it and seeing the pictures and the way you were described, your way of life, do you feel it accurately represented everything that was going on in your life and your family's life then?
Ben, I think it was pretty close. I mean, it was interesting. They used a couple terms called, you know, the vanishing rustic life of a farm community, of which I think for us as Iowans, I'm not sure that we would call it vanishing, and I'm not sure we'd call it rustic, but it's a tremendous quality of life that I appreciate, and I think most Iowans probably appreciate. So I guess from a sense, Newsweek probably painted it as being someplace out there in the far, far west, and maybe we were lucky to have TV, lucky to have radio, maybe lucky to have a phone, but that was probably my take in the fact that we probably weren't as isolated as it pictured on that. But, you know, the rest of it was pretty close, and as you may have seen in the article, I was very fortunate in the fact that I was exposed to a lot of things that, you know, my young life, it probably was beyond just the scope of just, you know, things here locally, pardon me.
Mm-hmm. So have you in the meantime witnessed this, I guess, according to Newsweek, rustic life vanishing?
Oh, Ben, I'm not sure. It's, you know, for sure I would say this, that probably that type of life probably has changed a little. I mean, the farming life has changed. You know, we sure have a lot of things that have exposed ourselves as far as media and things like that have changed it from being a quiet kind of a you know, reflection type of a life. But I don't know that I'd say it was vanishing, because the interesting thing that you see today with some of the teenagers in the community and a few of these, I mean, you see things where FFA, for example, in the school, and 4-H and some of those, they've actually increased in some of their kids that are taking those classes, and you see the growth at like Iowa State University, which is where I went to school. I mean, my gosh, that school is almost twice the enrollment of what it was when I was there, and many of them are in the agriculture side of the college.
Mm-hmm. So more opportunities for teenagers these days.
I think so, and the interesting thing is I think some of them, even though they may not have grown up in a farm area, have a chance to get involved in agriculture, where that's genetics, whether it's seed, whether it's fertilizer, whether it's, you know, ethanol, all those things, which is way beyond the scope that we saw 50 years ago.
Here's an interesting footnote I'd like to have you talk about briefly before we go. Your father worked with Professor John Vincent Antonasoff, who created
Yes.
the first electronic digital computer, also involved in the Manhattan Project, which built the first A-bomb. Did you realize the extent of what your father was working on at the time?
A little bit. I mean, he was a very humble individual. He was very proud of his background working for Maytag. Would have enlisted in the service with his brothers, but he was a mechanical engineer from Iowa State. He was fortunate to have worked with Antonasoff and Cliff Berry about in the invention of the first computer, and then having been involved in metallurgy and Maytag, that's where they got involved in a lot of the research that went to the Manhattan Project. And I can remember one of his stories talking about taking uranium in a suitcase in a train going to Chicago. So, but one of those things that you just never really, he was, like I say, a very humble individual, and didn't, it was just something that was done because it was a course of, you know, how the United States handled things back in the pre-war time.
Right, right. You now live in Newton, but you spent some time away from Newton?
Ben, I did. I graduated from Iowa State University, got involved in the meat industry. As you move up your career and your ladder of opportunity, we moved 11 times from Iowa to Oklahoma to South Dakota to Cincinnati and New York. So yeah, you know, it's been a good career. I've spent, you know, well over 40 some years in it, and then I've had a couple downsizings, of which the last one I was in a place called Sparta, New Jersey, and I'm working in downtown Manhattan and commuting and riding the train, you know, an hour and 45 minutes each way every day. And so I had the opportunity after the downsizing to come back to my roots, back to Iowa. Unfortunately, my father had passed away, but I rebuilt the old farmhouse that I grew up in. And so right now I'm fortunate enough to be a part owner of a company, and I work directly out of my house, and I spend part of the time putting in some corn and soybeans in a 120-acre farm in my spare time.
Excellent. Well, that's a nice, very nice life you've described there in a nutshell. Thank you for talking with us, Bruce Curtis, a Newton resident, one of the teenagers that Newsweek profiled 50 years ago in 1966, and Newsweek has checked back with these former teenagers in a new article. Bruce Curtis, thanks for sharing memories with us.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate your time.
And finally today, we check in with Elwin Taylor to find out how planting progress is going and about our weather that our crops and we humans are experiencing. Elwin Taylor, professor of ag meteorology at Iowa State University. Hello, Elwin.
Well, good afternoon. It's good to be with you.
We have about 5 minutes, so let's start with the crops. How many crops are in the ground? Corn, beans?
Well, the corn has been planted, vigorously. It's not going to be complete. Well, it's never complete, but essentially complete. We'll still be a ways away. There's been some interruption because of just too much moisture. It doesn't look like it's the type of interruption, however, that will affect the state yield or national picture, but it just affects individuals. So they've been saying, will we get over having this excess moisture without going to a drought? That is the question.
Uh-huh.
And it, right now, we would say the odds favor that, yes, we will go to more mild conditions as far as moisture is concerned without switching to the heat and lack of rain that constitutes drought conditions, at least not before we get into October or something like that. Meaning that we will still anticipate that the U.S. corn crop, the yield per acre, will be well above the trend, probably around 170 bushels the acre for national average.
Mm-hmm. And far fewer beans planted at this point. Is that by design?
For the most part, the beans don't do as well at low temperatures. When the temperatures slip below 50 degrees at the 4-inch depth in the soil, beans don't do as well as corn. Neither one will grow at that temperature, or only grow but very slowly. And diseases might grow faster. Beans are more susceptible to having problems at low temperatures, especially at high moisture, than corn is.
Mm-hmm. So let's switch over to the weather that both the crops and that we will be experiencing and have experienced. It's been a bit colder and wetter than a normal spring. I haven't looked at any data, but what does your data tell you?
Well, it agrees with that. And we've had colder and wetter years, but this is in that class. At the present time, the airflow from the Gulf of Mexico that brings in the moisture is not direct into the Midwest. And so we have a little bit of relief, even though there's precipitation moving through the central portion of the Corn Belt today.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what's in store for us in the coming weeks, as far as we can tell, heading through the spring and into the summer?
The National Weather Service gives us a 10-day outlook and the 14-day outlook. These are better than a guess, at least that we can say that much about them. They do anticipate that taking us through the 22nd of May here in the northern portion of the Corn Belt, that would be Iowa, Minnesota, and immediate neighbors, up in that area, would be on the warm side of usual. That will be pleasant. Also, the southeastern U.S., all the way from southern Texas to Virginia and everything south of that, be on the warm side of usual. cool side of usual west of the continental divide. We anticipate that precipitation will change to below normal for Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and maybe above normal still in the Ohio River Valley and from there to the south, and above normal in the northwestern portion of the United States as well.
Okay.
So that outlook is not discouraging at all, but looking further ahead, the 14-day outlook, finish up May, warmer than usual temperatures, everything east of the Continental Divide.
Okay.
Slight chance of being on the wet side.
All right. Elwin Taylor, professor of ag meteorology at Iowa State University. Always good to get an update from you, Elwin Taylor. Thanks so much.
Good to be with you.
Coming up Monday on this program, thanks to the work of a class at Central College in Pella, three men from South Asia who were persecuted, even tortured, are now living here in the U.S. We'll hear about that story on Monday on this program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.